everybody, and welcome back to the War Room, part of the Clone Star podcast. I'm your host, Joe Hurley, and this week I'm joined by my regular co-host, Mike Overton. Mike, how are you today?
I'm good, thank you, sure.
Except for that massive headache that you told me you had before we started recording. And this week, we're joined by a man that you may know from various appearances in Star Trek in The Next Generation, Voyager, three times on DS9, and a hefty seven times as the Suleiman Silic in Enterprise. And he was also regular on Carnival as Gecko. And he has a list of movie and TV appearances that are way too long to even mention. So this week, we are delighted to be joined by the critically acclaimed actor and performance artist, John Fleck. John, how are you?
I miss my voice. I can't talk.
No, I'm fine. I'm good.
John, I was going through your bio and there was something that immediately jumped out, and I said I have to start the interview and ask him this, because if I don't, I'll be very disappointed. In your bio on the website, it says an actor since 1976. He gained notoriety as a performance artist in 1983 when he climbed on top of the one-way bar in Silver Lake at a monthly event called Theoretical and proceeded to striptease while singing Puccini's Madame Butterfly. You see me hiding your face there, John. Now, this is your life, so I'm very curious. How does one striptease while singing Puccini's Madame Butterfly? And did you do it well?
Here, I'll show you right now.
But after one of those banners that says too hot for TV on it when we're editing.
We'll have to put black bars over the bits, yeah.
Oh, you know, well, you know, I came out here to be an actor, and, you know, I did. I went to the American Academy of Dramatic Arts, like, in the mid-70s, and then I got out, and then, you know, you start auditioning for a little theater, and, you know, I survived by typing. I could type 120 words a minute, so, but anyways, I used to hang out at these clubs in Hollywood and Silver Lake, which is right by Hollywood here in L.A., and they were kind of punk clubs, and I started getting in with the performance art crowd, and so I was asked by the guy that held these monthly events at this one way, which was like, God, how would you describe it? Like, God, like an S&M leather punk bar, primarily gay, but these events were very kind of, you know, mixed men, women, but everybody was loaded with tattoos. This was before anybody had tattoos, and these people were all tattooed and piercings and the hair up to here. And woo, it was, you know, kind of crazy. So he asked me to open for Edie Massey. I don't know if you know Edie Massey. She was the egg lady in John Waters' Pink Flamingos, I think. She was in a lot of his. Anyway, she was on stage and he asked me to open for her. And I never, you know, in this. Oh, shit. Let me turn off my phone. Where is it here? Yeah. Oh, surprise, surprise. It's Scam Likely. I'll turn that off. So,
Scam Likely always makes phone calls at the wrong time. Yeah, poor Scam Likely.
Scam, Madam Scam. Oh boy. So, I climbed on the bar and I knew I had to kind of wow them, because they if they didn't like you, they'd throw a beer bottle at you, you know. So it was, you know, your life in your hands. And I had been training. I had like a 4-octave voice, which I can still hit the high notes now. So I got up there and this is not the highlight of my career here, but, you know, since you asked. So I basically, you know, I got up on stage. God, everybody's going to turn your podcast off after I tell you this story here. But I slowly pulled my pants down and I sang, "There's no penis like show penis and no penis I know." You know, like everybody's looking, what the fuck? Oh, I don't know if I'm allowed to swear.
Oh, you're fine. You're fine.
Okay. And then, you know, before they could clutch their beer bottle and throw it at me, I started singing, you know, the Madame Butterfly song, and all pranced about. Oh, and then I had feathers. I had pink feathers, and I sang the song Flamingo. And, oh, anyways, it was not the best, but hey, they didn't throw a beer bottle at me, and it was all uphill or downhill from there. So there you have it.
So wait a second. When you went on stage, had you all this rehearsed, or did you just say, do you know what, I'm just going to do whatever the hell comes to mind?
Well, I had a mind. I knew what I was going to do, you know, but you always have to allow for improv, you know, just in case to dump a beer bottle or something. But no, it was pretty well planned out, but always allowing for the improvisational mode to kick in, so to speak. Survival mode, as I call it, yes.
So going back all the way to the start, like, what got you into acting originally? Like, did you grow up in like a creative household? Was there kind of, or like, did you just kind of just decide to branch out and do what you wanted to do yourself?
You know, there was nobody was ever an actor or performer. You know, my father was a carpenter guy and my mother was a housewife. You know, she had seven kids, you know, Irish Catholic, you know, and German father. Yeah, I think... Anyways, I won't go into their relationship, but no, they're, I don't know, you know, we just moved so much, you know, I went to like 10 different schools before I graduated from high school. And so I was often, I didn't have a lot of friends. So I think I kind of got into my imagination and I, you know, have these little imaginary characters I pretend to be to escape the grim reality of living in that household. So my creative imagination was triggered. And then I went to Europe when I was 20 years old. You know, it was during the Vietnam War and my draft number came up. It was 29, which was pretty assured that I would be drafted. I was like, oh shit, I never fired a gun. I couldn't do it. So I hopped on a plane by myself and I went to, I flew into London and then I was there for almost 4 months, you know, traveling around Europe with my your rail pass and my little, you know, youth hostel card. And I met so many creative people there. And I came back and I had a girlfriend at the time and I started to do little community theater. Anyway, she was coming to Los Angeles in 1974 to go to acting school. And she says, why don't you come audition, you know, and do it? And I never really thought, I had tried to take an acting class in college, but I was so terrified, you know, oh God. But anyways, it was my escape from Cleveland and I came out here and went to acting school. And I guess that was the beginning of it all. Yeah.
And when you went to acting school then, like, did you find it easy to come out of your shell or were you kind of like, did it take a bit of time for that to kind of develop within you?
I think it took a little time, but the shell was cracking open, you know, if we're going to go with that image. Yeah, my shell was cracking open, and I realized I did have a talent, you know, some talent. And so I just kept taking acting classes after I got out of there, the American Academy of Dramatic Arts. And, you know, I studied voice, and I studied tap dancing. And, you know, it's funny, even though I had no encouragement, you know, or creative background in my family. My father always said, you need to learn to tap dance. So I, you know, I learned how to tap dance. I studied for many years. And
Wait a second. Why did your father pick tap dance of absolute, like, there's a lot of things he could have picked there. Why tap dancing? I have to understand that.
Well, my mother wanted me to be an accountant, you know, because they were very working class and never had a nickel to their name. So, you know, accountant equals money. And my dad, I would do his books for him, you know, when he was working, you know, just some simple ledgers, you know, coming in, going out. And I do have a talent with bookkeeping and numbers. And thank God I managed to do okay financially in my life. But my dad, he was, you know, he was a creative guy. He painted, you know, sometimes and he had a little accordion that he played, you know, when he got drunk. and I don't know why he told me to take tap dancing lessons, but he always did. So I guess the tap dancing impressed him. So I you know, I learned to do a nice little, you know, shuffle off to Buffalo. One of my first little gigs here in Hollywood, you know, after I got out of acting class, I did the Gong Show. I don't know if you guys ever
heard. I've heard of the Gong Show, yeah.
It was big in the 70s out here. And that's actually how I got my Screen Actors Guild card, is I auditioned for the Gong Show. And I did, I tap danced and I whistled without moving my lips. See, that was one of my unusual talents. Just put on my early resume, I could whistle without moving my lips. So I do this. So here, I'll do a little version. So I'm doing the little soft shoe and I'm whistling and they're all looking at me like, what the hell? Because, you know, that was a bad choice for TV because they thought it was a recording, you know, like, okay, he's not moving his lips. Where's the sound coming from? They almost gonged me, but they didn't. And I ended up getting, like, they used to give you cases of cough syrup, you know, little, I don't know, crazy things, like little gifts. Yeah.
And your prize this week, a lifetime supply of cough syrup.
I don't know. They gave me all kinds of weird things, soap, and I think there was not, maybe not cough syrup, it's in my imagination, but hey, but that's how I got my union card, so thank you, Gong Show.
Like, after you got out of college, then, like, were you kind of there going, I want to do something in performance arts, I want to do something in theater, I want to be, like, on TVs, movies? What was the kind of objective at this point?
What was my objective at this point? Well, you know, I had to stay alive out here. I had driven cross country, and, you know, my family didn't give me any money, so I had to survive, you know. So that was my primary thing. But, you know, I hit the ground running. I just knew this was my calling, so to speak, to be an actor. And I'm so thankful I managed to, you know, find, you know, club work and the cabaret scene, if you will, you know, that just to, you know, actually I was a part of a panel last week at a little university out here, Cal State University, for the graduate students, the theater students, and the panel of performance artists like me, and just, you know, like to give kids, like, okay, the options. We all want to be creative, you know, and it's, if you put all your eggs into this auditioning for TV and film, oh, you're always waiting. What can you do to be creative and not always waiting for somebody to give you a job so you can create your own work, you know? And that's what I learned. That's where I started to become a, if you will, a performance artist, you know, back in the early 80s is when I started booming in that regard. Anyways, I forget what the question was. Sorry.
What did you enjoy about performance arts then?
Oh, geez. Well, the freedom, the imagination. I was studying with all these great teachers that really encouraged me to improv and blah, 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 you know, and go on these creative tangents. And I just started creating these little pieces that grew into bigger pieces and into bigger spaces. And, you know, that's when I'm most alive, is when I'm being creative, you know, as so many of us creative folks, you know that. You just, something's calling us. Why are you doing this podcast? You just, I don't know, it's something that we have to do. You know, our creative higher power is leading this in that path. So,
and just looking at your, like, IMDb list of all the kind of the credentials that you have in terms of movie and TV appearances, there's so many of them, and they're so kind of different in terms of, say, different characters, different motivations, et cetera, et cetera. Is that what's kind of appealed to you about all these characters? It's so many different characters you've played. So that means you're not just sticking to one type. You're constantly going around and doing different things.
I often wonder, maybe I could have been more focused in terms of my career. I decided, you know, after I've been out here for like 10 years doing theater, I needed to make some money creatively. So that's when I go, you know, come on, John, let's get an agent. Let's try to do some TV film, you know. And that's what I was doing. And then, you know, these roles would start coming my way, and I'd do them, you know, and I'd get cast, you know, and then all these Star Treks started to happen, you know, in the early 90s. It's funny, after the whole NEA4 thing, this controversy thing, we haven't talked about it yet. But you're
no.
Aware, right? Oh, that's one of the questions coming up.
This, yes, it is. Yeah, you're preempting my notes, John. It's all here.
I can read your dirty mind. I know what you're thinking. Okay. But, okay, so... Anyways, hey, the boy was just trying to make him a living, and I learned, boy, you can make some decent big bucks doing TV stuff, you know? I remember my first lesson in how much money you can make. I was doing a theater piece in the mid-80s, and I got cast in this little commercial, and I told my agent, you know, I can't work on these days because I'm doing the theater. Anyways, they wanted me to shoot the night of the show, and I said, I can't do it. So, okay, so... I pass, and then my agent called back. Okay, they're gonna, let's say I was making 750 a day. Okay, then, okay, they'll give you $1,000. I go, I can't do it. They go, okay. She came back, okay, they'll give you $2,000. I go, I can't do it. I'm committed. Anyways, the director ended up calling. He says, I'll give you $7,500 if you do it. I go, So I canceled the show that night and I did it.
So in other words, you learned to haggle really well.
I know. Well, the power of no, you know, it's sometimes if you say no, that's when they really want you. Hollywood is so screwy. If they can't have you, they got to have you, you know.
And John, if you were to pick then performance art, theater, movies and TV, which is your favorite?
Well, you know, I do love shooting film. It's just the opportunities aren't happening as much, even though, you know, last year I did do this very low budget film called Dead Mail, and I had the lead role in it. And that was just so rewarding, if not financially, creatively, and to know that I could carry and sustain a movie. And the good news is I just heard a couple weeks back that our film is going to be in the South by Southwest Film Festival in Austin, Texas. So I'm going to fly out there on March 8th for 4 nights and see the film. And, you know, I mean, these guys are incredible. They shot this movie, a full-length feature. They wrote it. They shot it. They've got a couple other films under their belt. But I think they did it for like $300,000, the entire film, which is nothing, you know.
Oh, wow, yeah.
And the fact that they got it into a film festival and, you know, it's, you know, anyways, in terms of your question, what would I rather do? Obviously I like to do it all, you know, but living here in Hollywood, you know, you're only as good as your last job. I wish I have made TV film kind of my God, you know, like that's when you really made it. So I'm trying to accept that, hey, you know what, I'm a creative person, and hey, I'm working on a new piece, performance piece, and hey, that's good too. That has value too. You know, it's so easy for me. Oh, if you're not making big bucks in the TV film business, then you're nobody. But I'm trying to open it up. I have my performance art, I have theater, and I have that. So how blessed I am. And you know, and I don't need the money, right? I'm financially solvent and I don't need the health insurance anymore. So, hey, you know, the world is my oyster if I look at it that way, you know, and not get resentful. I'm not working more in the TV business anymore.
And what's your creative process, John? As you said, like, you're a very creative kind of guy. Like, if you're approaching, say, be it a role on TV, be it performance art or anything like that, what's the kind of approach that you take? Obviously, it's going to vary per project and all that, and then vary per person. But what do you think is the way you approach things best?
Well, the creative process, you know, for an acting role, a traditional TV film or theater role, you know, you read the script. You know, and where do you fit in with that? What's your relationships with everybody else, and what do I need? What do I want, and what can I do in each scene to engage with my partner? I mean, you know, it's a very kind of active process. I mean, I love that discovery. You know, in terms of my own work, I don't know. It's kind of got a bigger scope, like where. Like I start off with little seeds, like a song or a phrase, and I build it. God, I don't know how to, you know, and it's just, you know, you plant these seeds and they take root. I just did a one-nighter in New York in November of this show. I discovered this singer, Beatrice Lilly. You've probably never heard of her, huh? She was a big vaudevillian singer back in the day. Anyways, just a magical, androgynous figure, and she really piqued my imagination. So I did a one-night thing called Beatrice Lilly, the Devil and Me, and kind of like the spirit of Beatrice Lilly saves me from this Bible-thumping father. You know, a lot of my work, you know, it seems autobiographical, but I always say, why let the truth stand in the way of a good story? So anyway, so there's elements of truth in my family situation, but Beatrice Lilly saves me. Anyway, it's evolving, and now I'm calling it "There Are Fairies at the Bottom of Our Garden," and based on a song that she wrote. And actually, when I was in Scotland just recently, we stopped at a fairy glen. They have a fairy glen over there, and that was really inspiring. I remember nobody was around. I remember singing that "There Are Fairies at the Bottom of Our Garden" in the fairy glen, and I don't know, just I kind of go where my creative muse leads me. I go, when I did that, I go, okay, that's where that my show's going. So anyways, I love to be creative. A lot of times I like last night, I had such a hard time sleeping because blah, 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 you know, the brain starts spinning. I just sometimes need to learn to, I need to channel it. If I don't channel it, then it kind of gets blah, 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 blah. So thankfully I have a place to channel it right now.
And John, the Adam Driver question that we always ask people, which is, do you find it hard to watch your own performances back?
Oh, well, that's very interesting. You know, when I did this panel, I actually taught a workshop last year at this little university, you know, basically self-taping for actors, because that's all the auditioning now is done through self-taping. So you have to videotape yourself. Is that the expression we use anymore since there's no video involved? But anyways, we tape ourselves and we
saw. Oh, we've aged ourselves. We've done it. We've done it yet again. We've aged ourselves with videotape.
No.
Why, John? Why did you need to do it? You had to bring up videotape, which nobody has anymore.
Yeah, I know. Well, what do we call it? We tape ourselves, right?
Record.
We record ourselves. Okay. We digitally record ourselves.
There we go.
There we are. And then we submit it. So anyways, long story short, I encourage these kids for actors and performance types that are creating their own self-scripted work to videotape themselves and look at themselves. You know, tape it, take a little breather, then come back. You know, we're actors. You think of yourself as a third-party observer looking at yourself. I have learned so much as I complain about these self-tapes, you know, because you have to be your own lighting designer, your own, you know, your editor, your sound recorder, you know, all that jazz. It's just been so helpful for me as an actor and a writer performer to look at myself on screen and go, oh, okay, slow down. I tend to talk really fast, you know. Oh, let that moment land. One great thing I learned from doing some of the Star Trek roles, I remember one of the directors, especially in all these big eyeball, you know, because it's all about the eyes with the big contacts. He says, always keep your chin down so your eyes stay open. Because I used to, especially since I play all these haughty characters, you know, you want to you keep the chin down so the eyes open. But I find that's true for all my acting too, because the eyes have it, so to speak. But long story short, I would recommend, if people can stomach it, to look at themselves. It can actually be a very valuable tool, you know, especially self-tapes, you know, you do it over and over and over, and I can see the mistakes I made, and then, you know, try to keep it fresh, but not to repeat some of the bad behavior choices.
And when you're doing these acting lessons and things like this, John, what are the kind of the main bits of advice that you give to young aspiring actors?
Well, you know, in terms of, you know, these very intimate, you know, close-up shots we're doing for self-tapes, you know, it's all about your partner. You know, like, you know, I say, oh, it's great to look at yourself afterwards, but no, because when we're acting, it's all about, for me, keeping it's engaged with my partner. It's all about trying to get something from them, or, you know, make them act a certain way, or to change them. So that's my biggest thing, you know, like, what are you fighting for in the scene? You know, and then what are your obstacles, and what are the contradictions and the you know, the opposites that can make this character interesting? Because, you know, we're not all just, you know, black and white. There's a lot of, you know, colors in there and shades of gray, and don't be afraid to, I say, always have a moment of, you know, silence. One great thing, you know, about doing these self-tapes, I always wanted to memorize, you know, the script. I like to be on book, but it's so much easier, you know, if I can kind of frame the shot like here, like I'm looking at myself right now, and have the script here, and just to know the lines that I need to really nail my character here, you know, just so it's. But you know, we don't always talk nonstop. A lot of times, you know, you gotta think about what you're gonna say. So it's a great opportunity to look down at your script and then pick up, you know. So it can actually work in your favor.
Use the negative space wisely. Yeah.
Mike, very well said. Yes. embellish that negative space. It's not all positive, active, you know. We receive too.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
Actually, John, have you ever had a situation where when you were on stage and you forgot a line?
Oh, yes. Well, actually, in terms of my own self-scripted work, that has happened. And now most of the time in my work, I incorporate that somewhere in the piece. Not that it's like, you know, he does that in every show, but it can work like a couple of times, like, where am I? And like an audience, like, whoa, okay. You know, line, and nobody knows you're going to say that anyway. But, you know, and anyways, that can kill a couple minutes, you know, and it kind of brings up an audience into like, whoa, I don't know where the fuck I am, but I could get out of it, you know, and who knows where I'll come out. But in terms of on stage, like in a theater piece. In somebody else's play. God, have I ever forgotten myself? God, I can't remember that, honestly. You know, and you know, TV, film, you know, if you forget, you know, God, then you just do it again. You know?
Yeah. What do you find is, especially in your performance art, especially in the theater and things like that, what do you make of, say, the connection between you and the audience? What do you look for from them? Like, are you trying to kind of get a connection with them, or are you just trying to drown it all out and just say, just going to focus on what's up here?
Well, I like to play with both that elements, like, yeah, okay, like just, you know, to suck them into the story, the presentation. But then I always like to break the fourth wall and kind of deal directly with them, you know. Sometimes even when I'm doing my own work, I like to start in the audience just to, you know, because there's that thing that a lot of actors, I don't want to know who's in the audience. Don't tell me who's in the audience. But for me, I find it rather liberating to know friends, enemies. I don't know, just to get it all out of the way. And okay, I know you're there and I'm not trying to hide from you. And
I can now slag you off on stage. Yeah.
Now what did you say? I can now what you off on
stage? So I can now slag you off on stage.
Oh, I thought you said something really filthy.
No.
This Jeez, is a family. This is a family podcast, John. We never say such a thing on this at all.
Black you up, right? And even if you're pulling a theater piece, I mean, you know the you know, and you're a character, you know, you're not breaking the fourth wall, but we all know there's an audience out there, and you know they're gonna laugh or react. So you know. And that's why we love theater, because of the live audience. You don't know what will happen. In my own work, I love it when mistakes happen. Like, you know, in my more controversial days as a performance artist, I'd often have times where people would storm out and go, you know, you're crazy, you know. And you learn, and I go, of course I'm crazy. I'm trying to do, you know, theater in Los Angeles. You've got to be crazy. Why bother?
Of course I'm crazy, I'm an actor.
John, what is the story of the NEA4?
The NEA4. Well, the NEA is the National Endowment for the Arts, a big funding source here in the States. And anyways, in 1989, fellow performance artist told me, he said, oh, you should apply for an NEA grant. I've never applied really for funding. You know, I was just a scrappy, pretty much clubs, very small theater performer. Anyway, so I applied for this NEA grant for a show I was working on called Blessed Are All the Little Fishes. And bada bing, I got it. You're like, wow, you know. I was one afternoon in 1990, I was doing a show at an AIDS hospice here in LA. I actually received a little city funding to perform there, which was kind of a nightmare. But anyways, I came home and I had like, speaking of, I got to get rid of my landline. Do you guys have landlines still, or did you get your landline?
Long gone now at this point.
You know, old habits. I don't answer it. It's all scam. So
hang on a second. You mean the scam person who tried ringing your mobile phone is now ringing the landline as well?
They're up to get me.
Do you know what I used to do? Every time I used to, because I was in the same boat, no one knew my landline. And it'll ring and I go, hello, you've for Janaya Doubtfire here, dear. And just go and just take them for a ride for as long as I possibly can.
Really? You know, maybe I should do that instead of like...
It'd be great. You'd be like, yes, there's a problem with your computer. Oh, dear, that's terrible. Really take them for a ride. It's brilliant.
You know, that might be fun. I'm going to try that. But anyways, back to the NEA thing. So I came home from doing the show at the AIDS hospice, and I had like 35 voice messages on my old answering machine. You know, back in the day, we had answering machines. And it's like from CNN and da-da-da-da. What's your reaction to, you know, Senator Jesse Helms saying that you're obscene and perverted? And then they had taken, they had rescinded our grants. I never heard of this. It was only through the messages on the machine. And so we had received the funding. They didn't tell us that they had pulled the funding, but they did. And the news broke fast, but a few conservative lawmakers, like Senator Jesse Helms from North Carolina and Dana Rohrabacher here in California, Orange County, they objected to the content of these four performance artists at the NEA4, as we ended up being called. And they labeled us obscene and, you know, disgusting, perverted. And it was Karen Finley, because she smeared chocolate over her naked body, and then there were three gay performance artists, me being one of them. And it kind of got ugly, and we went to the Supreme Court. We had lawyers who jumped right in, and we went to the Supreme Court, and actually the Supreme Court ruled in our favor. You cannot apply standards of morality on art. I mean, who's the who's going to decide what's moral, what isn't? And so he won. But then President Clinton, Bill Clinton at the time, threw a little red meat to the conservatives, and he appealed that decision. So basically the NEA said they could impose standards of morality. And God, I feel bad. I got funded under under New Genre. So after that, they deleted New Genre, you know, from their funding categories. But we received our grants, and, you know, most of the money went to the attorneys. But hey, no publicity is bad publicity, as bad as it was, you know, because we spent all our time, you know, we're not, you know, we're morally concerned artists. And yes, we do use extreme forms of body, you know, but it's with a higher purpose and a higher story. You know, it was the 80s, you know, we all were using our bodies in these kind of ways. And but like I said, there's no such thing as bad press, because that's when I started getting interest from casting directors. You know, they start bringing me in, and I actually managed to get an agent. And the casting people, you know, because the thing that got me in trouble was I peed on stage while reading a Bible. Okay, so just, I mean, so, you know, and they loved that. Oh, John Fleck, the man who urinates on stage. Or John, like the man who masturbates on stage. I never masturbated on stage, but anyways, I used to like split myself into male, female, and just be aggressive, and I kind of rape myself metaphorically. Anyways, I did not masturbate, but I did pee on stage. But you know, there's a bigger picture to it besides the shocking element. But hey, you got to give the old guy credit. I can pee on cue. Not everybody can do that. You try it. You try it right now. Come on, Mike. I want to see you do it. No, Mike, I'm only kidding. He's peeing right now. Oh, Jesus. But anyways, back to there's no press, bad press. And so they started calling me in, and you know, Then they finally get over, you know, don't pee on the furniture. Ugh. But anyways, I started working. And then the Star Trek stuff started to happen in the early 90s. And they liked me on Star Trek. David Livingston, I remember him. He was one of the directors. And he'd call me in to play all these different characters. And that's when Murder One happened, because they were reading about me. And, you know, so, you know, any press is good press. Your name's out there. And I had some talent, so I started working. So I was very thankful.
And during your career then, like, so who were some of the kind of the performers that you would have looked up to, that you would have admired, that you would have said, I want to kind of be like them? Or was there anyone like that?
Oh, Jesus. Oh, God. Well,
you come here, John, for the hard questions. We tell you the hard questions. You tell us about urinating on stage while reading the Bible. It's a fair trade, I think.
Oh, Jesus. Well, you know, I mean, back to that image, that horrible image, because I know the Bible's a sacred book, but I was trying to kind of play with the philosophy. You know, President Harry S. Truman once said, you know, one man's profanity is another man's philosophy. So I was trying to, you know, as this man's reading, he's overcome, like a miracle happens, and he, it's like a golden shower appears, so to speak, and he reaches down into the toilet bowl, and a goldfish is there. And I don't know, I was playing with, you know, how do we define a miracle, you know? So that's what I was playing with. You know, I was a punk rocker. What can I say? You know, it was all about shocking people. So, who were some of the people that I looked up to? Well, it's changed over the years. I mean, you know, I mean, Tim Curry, he was a big, you know, I mean, got it back in the 80s, you know, the Rocky Horror Picture Show. Who really...
Tim Curry is consistently brilliant, and no matter what he's in, like, I was watching TV on the weekend and he was in Loaded Weapon 1 with Emilio Estevez and Samuel L. Jackson. He's just brilliant. He's not in a whole lot of scenes, but any scene he's in, he's just magnificent.
I just asked somebody about him the other night. What happened to Tim? Whatever happened to Tim Curry? That's that song from Rocky Horror Picture Show. So whatever happened to something. But anyways, I guess he had a stroke or something. Have you heard that?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, he's having a hard time. So I wish him well. He's a very talented man. But who are my other performers? God, there's so many good actors. I mean, right now, you know, we just watch Poor Things. You know, Mark Ruffalo. He's so God. I remember seeing him on stage here in LA, God, back in the 80s, you know, even a little off, you know, like 30 seat theater, you know. So, hey, it's nice when you see actors, you know, making it, so to speak. So, I don't know.
Just on that, John, outside of Mark Ruffalo, you saw him on stage. Was there any other actors you saw on kind of stage at the start of their career who've gone on to much bigger things?
What, Jesus, who's gone on to much bigger things? Wow.
Again, I'm really testing your memory, John, here, to be honest with you. Every question is kind of drawing it all back.
Right. Well, I'm just trying to think. You know, a lot of my actor buddies are still doing TV and film, but did anybody become a really big star? No. I can't, you know, I'm sorry, I'm just... having a blank on that.
You don't need to apologize, John. We did land this question on you. Absolutely.
It'll pop out randomly. Okay.
I'll get a phone call at 3 o'clock in the morning that'll say scam likely, and it'll be John on the other end of the phone. Hang on a second, I've got the answer right here. Let me tell you who it is.
What time is it there now? You're 8 hours ahead of us. So it's like seven.
Just gone
20 past seven.
Yeah.
Okay. Or 1900.
Yes.
John, in terms of, say, outside of obviously Star Trek, what are some of the other roles that you've really enjoyed doing over the years? I know before we started the podcast, we discussed Murder One, which you did enjoy. And obviously as well, Carnival as well, I'm guessing would be on the list.
You know, Carnival, you know, I think I got into TV film because I wanted to make a living. So for me, you know, I love how handsomely they pay you, you know. Carnival, you know, it was a series regular, which is, you know, looks good on the, you know, IMDb, you know, series regular. But it was I call it a torture pay because I had all that makeup, you know. I'd have to oftentimes show up at 3 in the morning, you know, for like a 4-hour makeup job so I can be ready by 7 a.m., you know. So, and that was, you know, I wrote a piece about that. I just had to do it a couple of times, full body, you know, prosthetics, and they glue it all over you. You know, it's not just makeup, it's prosthetics, you know, very thin. So you lay, you know, they put you in a little thong, you know, and they're gluing you at 4 in the morning, and then 5 in the morning, then they flip you over, and you almost feel like a rotisserie chicken, you know. It's like they're like basting you and prodding, and you know, and you know your ass is in their face pretty much, you know, and they're gluing stuff on you. Oh my God. But anyways, hey, I made a whole bunch of overtime and a series regular pay. So thank you. The only problem with playing these non-human, well, Gecko was human. He just had a skin condition. But it was during that time I was also finishing up my last episode of Star Trek Enterprise. So I would go, you know, in between shooting on Carnival and all this makeup, I would be shooting Enterprise with all this makeup. And the killer thing about these roles is it's the removal of these pieces. It takes a lot of time. And it almost, you know, you feel like your skin is being pulled off at the end of the day. And they're, oh, you know, just be gentle, guys. And my skin was getting so dry and so damaged. So I learned a lot about skincare products during this time period, you know. But back to what I was saying, you know, I got a little typecast as the makeup man, you know, almost like Doug Jones, that actor who does a lot of the, you know, stuff. You know, you get typecast. And, you know, I made a, you know, joke out of, you know, I don't play human beings anymore. You know, I play these creatures. But hey, once again, they pay very well, and the residuals are very nice, especially for the Star Trek roles that keep rolling in. So in terms of what roles did I really enjoy? Oh, I mean, I enjoyed them. You know, I just finished up on Orville, you know, before they canceled it. Was this going to be another question, or am I jumping ahead?
No, you're fine. You're absolutely fine. Yeah, work away.
Oh, okay. But once again, it was a lot of makeup. And very financially rewarding, but I mean, is it? Are they a lot of fun? Nobody knows who you are. I mean, one hand, you know, you don't have to worry about shaving or showering or anything because you know you're under all this makeup. But you know, as an actor, nobody knows who you are. You know, when you're out of the makeup, you know, so that's humbling. But in terms of my favorite roles, I mean, this role I did last year, you know, God, that was so complex and human. I love that. And, you know, I've done a lot of little movies along the way that I really enjoyed. I just like to act and have some meat to chew on, you know, and have some really good back and forth with other actors. So, yeah.
And what are some of the roles that kind of you feel challenge you best then, these kind of situations?
Oh, geez, what was the challenge? Well, I mean, not to keep bringing up this little movie, Dead Nail, that I'm going to South by Southwest, that was really challenging. Somebody, a very sweet, reclusive man who ends up being a killer, you know, but it's all about him trying to survive. I always try to make everything I do, I really try to make it whole and as meaningful for me and hopefully for the watcher as possible to see a complex, you know, person or even, you know, as an alien, a monster, how human can I make these, you know, monsters, so to speak. So that's always rewarding when I can do that. You know, I just love to act. So, hey, you know, I'm available, and I hope you guys have a film job you can offer me soon. That's why I'm doing this, you know.
Yeah, Clone Star, the movie. It's coming out in 2030, yeah?
2030? Oh, boy, you better hurry. I ain't getting any younger.
John, one thing is that I noticed, you were in Waterworld.
Yes.
How much of a troubled production was it, as we're always led to believe that it was disastrous?
I know, the biggest flop of all time. I actually think it's turned a profit. I think, you know, over the years, it's kind of legendary. Well, you know what? Hey, Can I remember I was with my former partner back in the day, like around 90, when was it, 94? And I auditioned for this Waterworld. I met Kevin Reynolds, I think the director was. Just charming.
Costner.
But the director, a friend of his, it wasn't his name, Kevin, as well. I can't remember.
I thought I thought Costner directed it. I could be wrong.
No, Costner didn't direct it. No. Yeah, it was a friend of his. And I think after the movie, was they
Kevin Reynolds.
Kevin Reynolds. Thank you. Anyway, so I auditioned and God, a month went by. And I, you know, you just, okay, next. You know, you forget about it. Anyway, I get a call from my agent. Okay, they want you in Hawaii tomorrow. Okay, what? Yeah, tomorrow. So pack up. So I packed up and went there. And anyways, I ended up being there for almost 4 months and I only worked one day. So, you know, in terms of they just didn't know what they were friggin' doing. It was a big set and they built all these things out in the water, you know, in Hawaii on the big island there. And I was referred to, I was a cover set, you know, if the bad weather came out, they couldn't shoot out there, they'd come shoot interiors with me. And anyways, they had really great weather and they ended up, they couldn't use any of the stuff they shot out there, but they never used me. So they kept me in Hawaii for 4 months, which was just glorious, you know, to get a per diem and to live on the beach. And
I mean, I can definitely think of worse places to be stuck at for 4 months.
Well, you know, Jack Black, Jack Black, that's a guy that's always inspired me. We've known each other, God, from the 80s when he was a young wee lad in Actors Gang, a theater company out here in L.A. Talented kid. Anyways, Jack Black flew to, he got that call. You got to be in Hawaii, you know, tomorrow, you know, not the same time as me. He was playing some kind of airplane pilot, a small role, but he ended up being there for almost 3.5 weeks, you know, and all he did was bring a toothbrush. So he had to buy all these clothes and everything. But yeah, it was pretty disorganized. So we came back to LA and they built all the set, interior sets that they had built in Hawaii. They shot them here and everything we shot was on a green screen. So, you know, the ocean's behind us, but we shot it in front of a green screen. So I ended up working about 6 months on it and, you know, made a lot of ka-ching, a lot of dough. And, you know,
Did you get a good tan when you were over in Hawaii?
You know, I'm not a tanner. I stay out of the sun, but I swam with the turtles and had a lot of friends visit me. It was just a glorious, glorious time, you know, and, you know, I met Bob Joy, Robert Joy. He's a friend, and he's actually doing a lot of TV work these days. And there was an English actor named Gerard Murphy. Was that his name? Anyways, he was great. And actually, when I went to London, I visited London in 1995, and it was when Murder One was released. I remember And the English were so kind. God, they treated me like a star. You know, it was just a tiny role, but people love Murder One over in England, you know. But I had lunch with Gerard Murphy, but I think he's died since then. We lost contact. So, but anyways, yes, it was a rather disarray, but I think Waterworld ended up making, being profitable, you know.
So, at some point. John, just in terms of Star Trek, did you grow up being a fan of Star Trek or when outside of, say, acting in it, or how did your knowledge of it come about?
Yeah, you know, I was never, you know, I remember watching the original Star Trek with William Shatner, but not, you know, I was not a zealot, you know, just if it was there, I watched it, but I didn't see every episode. And so no, I wasn't. And you know, I was so, God, you know, when I started doing all these Star Treks, I never watched any of them that I did. Isn't that something? Well, we didn't have cable back then, for one thing, you know, and I don't know. I guess perhaps I could have been more successful in the TV world if I had perhaps treated it with a little bit more respect. I just considered it a day job, you know, did it, done, moving on, you know.
No. So hang on a second. In the 12 episodes of Star Trek then you've been in, have you ever actually watched them back?
Oh, over the years, especially I just decided, well, maybe I should make a sci-fi reel. I have an acting reel on my IMDb page. Yeah. Maybe I should make a sci-fi reel. So I have been, you know, especially with, you know, digitalization here, I can, you know, you can see anything and everything. So I have been watching them. And once again, my advice to young actors or old actors or any actors, it's helpful to watch yourself after you do it. Because like I was watching Star Trek Enterprise, trying to find a scene from there to choose. And my posture was so bad. I go, oh my God, I have a beer belly in one of the scenes. Aliens don't have beer bellies. And I go, you know, had I seen myself, I could have corrected my posture a little bit more, you know. But
so looking back at it now, would you do anything differently?
Oh, geez. Well, how would I do? Like, what do you mean? Do it in terms of...
Would you approach any of the Star Trek roles that you've done differently? Would you have done something different with the character? Or,
well, you know, had I chosen a different approach, they might not have cast me. So I obviously what I gave them is what they wanted. And then, you know, you take direction and, you know, tweak it along the way. I don't know. Acting wise, I think I nailed most of it, but maybe some technical things. I mean, I'm so grateful for that one director that said, you know, keep your chin down, show those eyes. You know, you're torturing yourself with those giant contacts. God, I hate contacts. You know, I don't wear them. And to have these giant things put in is truly torturous. I really can't think of anything that I do differently from an acting point of view, just maybe technically, you know, stuff like that. Yeah.
So in terms of how it all came about, was it because of the controversy with the DEA or the NEA-4, or was it
controversy? Yeah. DOA-4. Okay. Are you saying were they connected, like the press from that?
Do you think that's how what brought, say, you to the attention of the Star Trek producers? Because obviously, look, you know, the roles that you've done, like starting out with The Next Generation, The Mind's Eye and all that, right. Like you play a very kind of, you have the height, you have the prominence, you're imposing, you've got this wonderfully like villainous voice. And I know you, Jan, it's a lovely voice you have. But when you're in Star Trek, it's a very villainous voice you have, especially for the Romulan that you played and the Cardassian in DS9 and things like that. But do you think, like, was it your acting or was it that controversy that brought you to their attention, do you think? Or could it be a mixture of both?
I think it's probably a mixture of both, maybe, you know. You know, yes, that happened. And then I just happened to get a decent agent, you know, that time period. So they were submitting me. And maybe because he knew of my background, he started submitting me for the Star Trek roles, you know, for these alien monster creatures. And maybe that did have something to do. But, you know, a lot of people, you know, they remember your name, but they don't know in what context, you know. And especially back then, we didn't have computers like, oh, Google, you know.
John, yeah, it's not like you could just Google someone to figure out who they are.
Right.
Look, I have to say this is like the fourth time we've aged ourselves in the podcast, right? We've had VHS tapes, we've had answering machines, we've now got, you couldn't Google yourself back into the day. We didn't have basic cable. So we've gone to four levels at this point. Before the podcast started, we did another one. So that's actually five times we've aged ourselves in this conversation. Yes.
Well, when you're, you know, when your career spans like 45 years, hello, it is a history of our technological innovation here.
Wow. So of all the roles then, John, which is the worst one for makeup then? Because you played two Romulans, you played a Cardassian, you've played a Cheaters Above, I can barely read this, is a Caraman. You played someone in Voyager. There's no Ray. So which was the worst makeup to get on? I'm assuming it's Silic, but I could be wrong.
I think you're wrong there. The worst in terms of the laborious process, probably, like I said, Gecko. They didn't do that many full bodies, but that could be a 5-hour makeup job just into it, and then another 2 to 3 hours to get out of it. But I do remember one horrible afternoon. I'm trying to, it was a Deep Space Nine, but they cast me as this character, and it begins with a C, not a Cardassian. When do you say Cardassian? I keep thinking of Kim Kardashian. Is that how we say Kardashian?
There's plenty of
hate
out there.
I think it was in the search part one, John. I think Caraman, yeah.
Okay. Well, anyways, I had to shoot it outside, and it was like we shot it like on location, which they usually didn't, but it was like out in the desert somewhere, and it was like 120 degrees, and all this makeup, and you're sweating, and your eyes, you get these contacts, and there's salt in your eyes. Oh, and I couldn't see where I was going, and I kept tripping, and I remember Nana Visitor, was that who's the
Yeah.
She, God bless her, she tried so hard not to keep laughing at me, but I kept like falling over rocks and take after take and the sweat dripping inside. So that was probably the worst one. But God.
And what was it like working on the sets? Like, you've obviously been on TNG, DS9, Voyager, and Enterprise. Which one, kind of like in terms of, say, the actors that you kind of worked with, like who were the kind of, well, I'm not going to say who was the nicest, who wasn't. Like who were the kind of the actors you kind of got on with when you were there?
Well, I got to say Scott Bakula in Enterprise, because I did so many more episodes. So you establish a relationship. He was just the nicest, kindest man, you know. Because he starred in the theater, I do find actors who come from theater tend to be the nicest ones. Actors, and I don't want to just, you know, categorize and make a cliche out of it. But I do find actors who came from theater tend to be a little bit more personable. A lot of just TV film actors just, you know, show up, you know, do your lines, get out, you know, and they barely look at you, you know? So I appreciate the humanity when somebody's nice to me and responds in a kind way. Scott Bakula really stands out. I remember LeVar Burton. That was like my first mind's eye. A very nice guy, you know, kind to me. You know, if you're kind to me, and, you know, because a lot of us guest star actors, you know, we're just little, you know, tools, you know, in the great fog, the machine, you know, so in, out, in, out. So, you know, a lot of people, stars, don't really have much to say to you. So, but for the most part, excuse me, everybody was really, really nice to me. I can't think of anybody who wasn't nice to me on Star Trek.
And what were some of your good memories of working on Star Trek over the years?
Oh, some of my good memories. Jesus. Getting the make-off off at the end of the day, that was always a good memory. I learned meditation. I really learned to really meditate very deeply, because, you know, most of the time when you're doing these things, you're in your trailer waiting to work, you know, it's, yeah, you know, you spend hours. And when you're, I remember one time, excuse me, I think I need some water. I'm choking.
You're fine, take time.
It's right here. I remember, I was working at Cilic on Enterprise. And, you know, between the makeup and these costumes, they're skin tight, you know. I mean, you can't even go to the bathroom without someone's assistance unzipping you, you know, to get out of your costume. It's very humbling. So, but I remember one time laying in my trailer and I started to panic, you know, it's just, you got these contacts and you just feel like you've been embalmed, you know, you can't breathe because you got all these girdles on. And one of the things when you play these aliens, you cannot have any genitalia bulge, you know, there are no penises, no genitalia in outer space. So they kind of pretty much like, you know, scrunch everything down with these girdles and stuff. So uncomfortable. Anyway, I'm starting to have a panic attack. I can't breathe. So I just, thank God I studied transcendental meditation back in the day, but I had forgotten about it, but it really got me in touch with, you know, breathing in and breathing out and, ooh, just, you know, relaxing and letting go and, ooh, getting out of here. And just, so that kind of, I mean, it has nothing to do with the acting, but I'm so thankful. It got me in touch with, meditation again, and that is kind of one of the things about acting, relaxation. You got to be relaxed, you got to kind of be present. You can't be up in your head, you can't be, you know, panicking and, oh, I'm gonna die, you know. So but in terms of the acting roles and all the Star Trek, God, I remember one, I don't even know what show it was on. I played a courtroom and I had big monologues. And I was a little scared that day, but damn it, I did it. It was very Shakespearean. That's what I find about a lot of these roles and why a lot of actors can't do it, because it is very specific form of communicating and language. It's almost Shakespearean in a way. You know, there's a lot of, you have to be very precise, and, you know, there's a lot of technical technical jargon, and, you know, it has to roll trippingly off your tongue. I remember auditioning for in the room for Silic on Star Trek. You know, you go in, it's at Paramount, and oh, there's Rick Berman, the creator, and all the directors and writers and producers. It can be a little nerve-wracking, but anyways, I did it, and I'm doing this long monologue, and I think I had a line, but I said, and I go, okay, let's keep the camera rolling. We don't say gonna in outer space. So I went back and I said that line, I've got to. And you know what? I think that's what book did for me. They appreciated that spontaneous. And that's one of the things about these whole self-tape things. You don't go in offices anymore. There's no one-on-one communication. And I swear, I worked a lot more, and a lot of actors feel this. You go in, you can charm an audience. And if you make a mistake, that's the thing. I love mistakes, because you can kind of correct it on your feet. You don't stop the scene, you keep going. And it just, you know, and then they can give you an adjustment, you know. And, you know, back in the day, you know, maybe there'd be 8 to 10, you know, other actors out for the same role. Now you've got, you know, up to 300 self-tapes coming into these casting offices. And a lot of the assistants, they don't know who us old timers are anymore. You know, they look at you for 5 seconds. Now, you know, next, next, next. So there's not, we don't have that human contact anymore. So I don't know. But on the other hand, I love self-taping. I don't have to leave home. I can do it as many times as I want. And it's kind of like a master class in, you know, film acting in a way. So.
And if the offer came around, John, because obviously there's so many new Star Trek shows at the moment, if you had the offer to go back and do it again, be it in an animated one, just with a voiceover, or go back onto one of the live action ones, would you do it?
In a heartbeat. Oh, yes, I would. I see, that's another thing. A lot of actors can't do that, you know, makeup stuff, because it can drive you insane. I'm okay with it. You know, I can turn it off and just go into hibernation when, you know, on a set, and you know, and then, you know, into the deep freeze, and then you come out and act. But I enjoy it. You know, I'm working on the Orville. You know, I did 3 episodes with Seth MacFarlane. And, you know, talk about a nice man, Seth MacFarlane. I like him very much. Very kind and respectful, and he works with you. He's very creative, you know, like, try this, try this, try that.
And of course, Seth was on Enterprise as well himself in 2 episodes.
Oh, he was. Why didn't I know that? Oh, shit, we could have had something to talk about. Oh, damn.
Oh, he was Ensign Rivers. Yeah, he was just briefly in 2 of them. Yeah,
which Star Trek?
Enterprise.
I'll be damned. Oh God. Well, maybe that's how I ended up getting the job, because he knew I was in Enterprise. I don't know. But yes, to answer your question, I would do it.
And what was the experience of working on the Orville like?
Oh, geez, what was that like? Well. God, I sound so mercenary, but when I talk about these things, it's all about the money. But you know, I gotta say, well, the last 2 episodes, it was basically, I got the second, the third episode in like 3 days before they shut down the industry when COVID happened.
Yeah.
So we were scheduled to shoot, and you know, it had just started to bubble up. And anyways, there was all this scheduling brouhaha with Ted Danson. He was in one of the scenes, and he's a busy working actor. He's a star, you know. So they kept they booked me, and then they postponed it for a month, and then they added another episode, and then they shot like the third episode one day, and then they took another 2-week break, and we came back and we shot this, and they were scrambling to get it all. Anyways, I ended up working like. On 2 episodes, I ended up working like 2.5. It was like a water world, basically, for me. I made so much money because they have to pay you for every, you know, week that they keep holding you. So, oh, but hey, But other than that, no, God, I just love being on the set. Playing aliens, or it just fun, and you really feel connected. It really is they talk about a family, but you are. We're all working together to create this piece, and I just love. And I mean, the actor Seth was great. I mean, he was busy. He kind of was directing too, as well as acting. I was so disappointed that I think it might have had more of a life in terms of another season if the pandemic hadn't come along. I think that took a lot of steam out of the show, and they canceled it. But I was set up to come back again, and I was really looking forward to that, but never happened. So.
And John, from what you're saying as well, is you're also advising our audience the best thing to do to support you is to rewatch all those episodes of Star Trek that you were in on repeat, because it'll build up the residuals that you get as a result. Is that correct?
Yes, I'm counting on you, show. I don't know. Is that how it works? Is that how it works? I don't know.
I do not know, but look, we'll find out by trying it and just see the Paramount suddenly noticed. Wait a second, John Fleck's episodes are doing really good here at the moment. Maybe we need to bring that man back.
Ah, there you have it. That's how it works, right?
Mike, I'm going to leave the last question to you.
Oh, you're leaving the last one to me. Okay. Yeah. John, this is a really easy question. You won't have to think about it at all.
Okay.
John Fleck, what does Star Trek mean to you?
Star Trek, what does that mean to me? Well, that means, it's a legacy. A skill that I, not that I didn't perfect, but that I could do well. I guess legacy. People remember Star Trek, and I'm so thankful. I'm here with you guys because it lives on. So I don't know, possibilities. I love the. That's why for me, the whole sci-fi world, just the imagination gets to run rampant. What if there were other worlds out there? I don't know. Did I answer your question?
Perfect.
You absolutely did, yes.
My hands are alive. Oh, God. Okay.
Mike, I'll let you do the wrap-up as well.
You want to do the wrap-up as well? Okay, fine. I always get the wrap-up for some reason.
You're a practiced hand at it, Mike.
Fine.
You're a good rapper.
Thanks, everyone, for tuning into this week's episode of The War Room. My co-host, the wonderful Joseph Hurley, and myself. If you'd like to catch up with more Clone Star podcasts, make sure you check out our website, clonestarpod.com, for incredible merch, as well as blogs and fan art written by you, our fans. Until next time, live long and prosper.